Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Dalton of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or just trying to make life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Today I talked to Brent Patterson. He's the political director of the Council of Canadians, and he will be in Guelph tonight, that is, if you're listening to this on the Wednesday, to talk about what is to be done, thoughts on how activists can navigate the current political moment. Of course, you know that we're living in a very polarized political moment, and it could be safe to say that Patterson is one of the polarizers. In other words, things are about to get very lefty on this edition of the Guelph Politicast. As you undoubtedly know, we're a little less than 11 months away from the next federal election. A lot can happen in 11 months. But without a boogeyman in the form of 10 years of Stephen Harper, Justin Trudeau's Liberals do have an uphill climb. And while it was always to be expected that they were going to get hit from the right, look for a strong left-wing backlash against the Liberals too, as progressives look at betrayal on promises about climate change, electoral reform, protection for middle-class workers. In the past week alone, the government has legislated striking postal workers back to work and has been forced to watch idly as GM announced the closure of its Oshawa plant. These are not great headwinds for Trudeau as we sail into 2019, and activists on the left are going to make him remember the promises made and the promises that weren't kept. And one of those people will be Brent Patterson. So who is Brent Patterson? I'll read you his bio. He's a political activist and writer. He has worked in solidarity with Revolutionary Nicaragua, advocated for the rights of prisoners in jails and federal prisons, taken part in civil disobedience actions in Toronto's financial district and at the Ontario legislature, and participated in street protests at the Battle of Seattle and at UN climate summits. He supported cross-country activism at the Council of Canadians for almost 20 years. Brent has a BA in political science from the University of Saskatchewan and an MA in international relations from York University. He sounds just like the sort of person who's going to be Trudeau's worst nightmare come next fall. So on this edition of the Guelph Politicast, I talked to Patterson about the then breaking news from Oshawa and what it says about the supposedly symbiotic relationship between governments and corporations. We talk about how Trudeau has painted himself between a rock and a hard place on oil pipelines. May have mixed my metaphors there. We also talked about the fight to fight climate change and whether we might be seeing some success there. And we talked about some of the things that we should be considering as activists, including some much-needed hopefulness. And last but not least, we talked about how hard it is, in a world full of stuff to be angry about, to not burn yourself out over it. I told you this was about to get lefty, right? Anyway, I caught up with Brent Patterson by phone earlier this week from Ottawa. Brent Patterson, thank you so much for talking to me today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Since, you know, it was a fairly heavy news day, a fairly consequential news day, I'll just start getting your opinion on this because, you know, it was big news. This we're talking on Monday evening, but it was broken yesterday evening that the Oshawa plant, the Oshawa GM plant was closed. And I'm sort of having this thought today, just from the tone of some of the ministers, the federal minister and Doug Ford, the premier, too. It seems like maybe it's dawning on them that their friends in corporations or, you know, maybe aren't such great friends, that maybe the goals are mutually exclusive or that, you know, they're not in it for the same reasons. And I thought this would be a great question to sort of tee you up on, because I can only imagine your reaction to this news today.
Well, that would be quite something, I think, if they had that observation or that reflection. I'm not sure if they're quite there yet, but yeah, I mean, clearly transnational capital, transnational corporations are you know, strictly in it for their for profit and not for community and not for workers and not even really for building economy. It's pretty self-serving, directly around profit, and that's, you know, part of the you know, a big part of the problem here in terms of when they're allowed to play such a central role in the Canadian economy and the global economy is that workers lose out, communities lose out, the environment lose out, certainly in terms of auto manufacturing, but in a whole range of areas, the public interest always comes second to corporate power.
Right. Except it feels like we the public have been sort of teed up to defend the corporate power, and you know, I don't think people particularly like corporations, but people will, you know, side with the idea that jobs, you know, are important, and, you know, even making a game out of it. And I think, you know, we saw that recently with the Amazon, you know, the contest for the second headquarters. It's not just a matter of, part of the responsibility of a government is to ensure the prosperity of the people. But, you know, now it's a game that a $1 trillion corporation has to, you know, get us to convince them that we are worthy of support.
Yeah, no, that's right. And, I think this is the issue that we do need to grapple with in terms of how we make an economy work for people and for communities and not just for the interests of transnational capital and a few wealthy people. And, you know, I guess, you know, and because there's always public money, or often public money, government money, our money, tax dollars, you know, involved in this. I mean, what comes to mind is, somewhat related to this is the $4.5 billion that the federal government put into purchasing the Trans Mountain pipeline from Kinder Morgan, and the additional $15 billion or so. You know, it's estimated that it could cost to actually build that pipeline. And by any measure, if you look at a $5 to $20 billion public investment into the economy, when it's put into a pipeline, the fossil fuel industry, it creates a relatively low number of jobs in relation to what it would in terms of wind power or solar power or mass transit or retrofitting buildings. And so, yes, we get sort of sold on this notion that it's corporations that bring jobs. That's not, you know, necessarily factually true. We also get sold on this this line that the fossil fuel industry is a great generator of jobs, but you know, there are various studies that say, you know, investment money put into other areas that don't, you know, pollute the land and water for future generations are actually better in terms of job creation. But I mean, you're absolutely right. It is part of the central dynamic, or part of the central debate in terms of what's in the media and probably around the dinner table, is we all need to work. We all need some form of income, and corporations use that as a lever against us, as it were. But surely there are other ways to structure economies that don't get us into these sorts of issues.
Right, and the pipeline is an interesting example of this push and pull, because you see the Trudeau government, you know, buying the pipeline, trying to plow full speed ahead with the expansion. And that angers a lot of people who support them and a lot of people who didn't support them. But a lot of people, you know, believe that the Trudeau government was going to make a strong push on environmental protection. But on the flip side of it is, and you saw this, I'm using the royal you as in all of us, but we saw this last week of, you know, people protesting Trudeau when he went to Calgary, because he's the perception there is that he's not trying to help get oil to market. And it puts Justin Trudeau and the Liberals in a weird position where, you know, they've pretty much angered everybody by trying to do the one thing that at least one of the sides says they want, which is to build the pipeline.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. I mean, it's a fascinating dynamic that you're pointing to, because in one sense, the liberals have had electoral success by, you know, relatively speaking, finding the political center and pulling in votes from both the left and right. It's kind of an old, you know, that's just numeric mathematical thing in terms of winning power is finding that center ground and pulling votes from different sides and you know, which they've successfully done at least recently. But you're quite right in terms of the purchasing of the Trans Mountain pipeline. They've angered you know, people who care about the climate, environmentalists, and so on, because you know, let us say, for sake of argument, $20 billion in terms of a pipeline is a massive fossil fuel subsidy from the party that ran on a platform of saying that you know, they would phase out fossil fuel subsidies. So that's kind of problematic. And then from the right wing, who might either be upset about the use of public money in that way, or higher taxes, or added to the deficit, or they're just, you know, some perception that the very modest measures, which would be even graciously putting it, even modest measures by the federal government, is somehow, you know, placing sort of this environmental stranglehold on the ability, you know, to extract oil and natural gas and frack and all that. So yeah, they've found themselves in an interesting political place on this one. But I mean, I still come down on the side that $5 billion, $20 billion to you know, buy a pipeline from a Texas based oil company is an extremely bad use of public funds and an extremely reckless public policy in a time of climate breakdown when we really need to be moving in the other direction.
Right. And one would think that would be something all points on the political spectrum could agree on, that, you know, whether or not we could get oil or building a pipeline, that should be, you know, come down to a private expense. That shouldn't be something the government should be involved in. And that would at least be the traditional conservative argument. Mm-hmm. And it would, you know, theoretically would have also given the liberals room to, you know, not own a pipeline, which is something that people on the left would be more than happy to not have on the books.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, I think as you've pointed out, they're getting squeezed from both ends on this, and you know, maybe taking a somewhat of a political hit on it. I mean, even there, though, part of the sort of broader challenge on this is, yes, let's say they're sort of politically getting a little tarnished around this decision because they also broke their promise on electoral reform that they had made during the 2015 election. Really, still, you know, they are in the range, in that popularity wise, that 40% popularity range that is enough to form a majority government, which in our, you know, parliamentary system is more or less 100% of the legislative power. So, I mean, it appears that they're willing to take the political hit. It appears, in terms of some of the polling and projections that I've seen, that, you know, it may not really hurt them in the 2019 election, but it certainly hurts the environment, and it certainly hurts the climate. It certainly accelerates climate breakdown. It certainly violates, you know, indigenous rights, and puts the fresh water, the oceans, the orcas at risk. And so they can, maybe they'll be able to skate through this, but the consequences are still there for us.
Right. Skate through is sort of an interesting phrase because, you know, it does seem like to me short-term thinking that, you know, there's a lot of eyes on what's going to happen next fall, but then, you know, what happens after that? And I think when you say like they can skate through that, that's like we're going to get over this hump of the election, but then we're still left with the same problems. And I would be very surprised if, you know, we're still here talking next year and there's still no shovel in the ground. There's still no pipeline being built. There's still no deadline. There's all these same questions will exist, and all that will have happened was an expensive election.
Well, yeah, I mean, it remains to be seen, I guess, in terms of you know, when construction can start and whatnot. But, you know, at the time of the federal court ruling, the Trudeau government was very clear that they, you know, that's perhaps a speed bump, but they're very committed to building the pipeline. And again, I mean, if we just sort of think electorally that historically, majority governments follow a first majority government tends to get a second majority government.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll be a smaller, but historically that's the case in Canada. And I saw some poll on the CBC the other day saying something like, I think it was 6 in 7 chance of either winning majority or winning the most number of seats. Things can change, but you know, it's still looking pretty good for the Liberals. And then if we see too, then the sort of the next option being the Conservatives, which are also supportive of the pipeline. It's just, you know, Trudeau's not building it fast enough kind of criticism. It's electorally difficult given, you know, quasi or some opposition from the NDP or the Greens, really sort of an ability to defeat it in the House. Hopefully it'll be a major election issue. Hopefully it'll have some impact, but I think it really points to the need for sustained organizing and mobilizing both against the pipeline and broadly on the climate justice front to ensure that we don't, you know, race off the cliff of climate change.
Right. And I want to pull back on that because you're coming to town on Wednesday, and you're going to be talking to the Council of Canadians chapter here. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things you're going to address is sort of how we people who are concerned about climate justice can get charged up and ready to campaign on that issue next year. I'm wondering, how can putting the environment front and center, what makes it maybe less of a challenge or maybe more of a challenge to make it a priority next year as opposed to any of the other years that has been tried to make a priority? Because I think, you know, it's sad state of affairs that even with, you know, the White House report on Friday, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report last month, I worry, and I'm sure you worry too, it's still not going to be something we're going to be talking about.
Yeah, I think it really is incumbent on all of us to make it a top of mind ballot box issue. It's not necessarily just going to happen on its own. I don't think the mainstream media is going to spin it as a, you know, as such. I think it really takes public pressure, public engagement, public involvement to make that happen, and you know, really repeating over and over again this, you know, you referenced the UN report in terms of, you know, the clock is ticking. There's 12 years left, you know, to keep global warming under the 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature increase. So there is an urgency to it. They're, you know, we have to make the argument that climate change isn't something that's coming. It'll certainly get worse, but it's not something that's coming. In many ways, it is already here. In terms of whether it's, you know, well, extreme weather events or wildfires or drought. I mean, there's any number of examples that can be pointed to. I mean, one of the things that I found particularly jarring was there's a study that came out, well, within the last couple of years by an international group that was saying something like 400,000 deaths around the world can be linked to climate change, 400 deaths a year that can be linked to climate change, and that number will only increase. And in terms of the mass forced migration that we're seeing around the world, the displacement of people, I think in terms of Syrian refugees, we often think of the civil war, but you know, you can trace some of the contributing factors to that war to drought, climate change, and drought, and forcing people from the countryside into the cities, and you know, and worsening the conditions around that conflict. The same with the caravan that we're seeing having made its way through Mexico towards the United States. Some good articles that highlight, yes, there's all kinds of factors in terms of repression and poverty, but some of that has been worsened by the impact of climate change on coffee crops and forcing people there. So yeah, it's not, you know, sometimes it's easy for a lot of us, for a lot of people, to live in a bubble and maybe think more about whatever, this tax or that or whatever.
Right.
But in terms of extreme weather events, in terms of mass migration, in terms of the clock ticking, these are really issues that we're going to be grappling with one way or the other. And it's much better to be dealing with it now than, you know, when the crisis is even worse 10 years from now.
Right. Which by that point, the crisis only inevitably gets worse. Cause,
exactly.
Yeah. I want to talk about some of the things that are going to be coming up in the talk. And one of the things that the Guelph chapter of the Council of Canadians listed was things we should be considered as activists. So I want to get I want you to expand on a couple of these. The first one that sort of struck me was actually number 16 on the list. It's a list of 16, but I'll start with number 16, which is be hopeful.
Yes.
Which I think is sort of fascinating when, you know, we're talking about existential threats like climate change, and we're talking about authoritarianism around the world, and you know, these are the things we are organizing against. But above all else, be hopeful.
Well, yes. I mean, it is an imperative to be hopeful and to continue to struggle and to continue to work for change. And even as dire as things may appear, or is even as dire as they are, and the forces that are lined up to maintain the status quo, you know, I think if we aren't hopeful, then it's easier to give up, and then it's a greater certainty that you know, the things will further worsen. And I don't know. I was really quite drawn to this quote by Ursula Le Guin, who's a science fiction writer, who basically said, you know, well, we live in a time of capitalism, You know, and it may seem impossible to change, but at one time so did the divine right of kings. And so I, you know, people will find inspiration in different ways, maybe in a book or in a movie or in a quote or music or, you know, from a life experience or from another person, whatnot. We all will find these things. I find that helpful, that if we look at, you know, in a historical context, to know that that things do change, that it is possible for change. But, you know, we don't have 100 years.
Right.
100 years. We have a very compressed timeline, so we need to sort of accelerate as best as possible. But anyways, that's where I draw some hope, and hopefully others will too.
I'm going to combine two of these because I think they sort of lift off from one another, but you on the list there's mobilize beyond e-petitions, and then there's think beyond the protest march. And I think there's something to that. I guess I find that, you know, we want people to do more than just be snarky on Twitter or, you know, write their name on change.org petition. Yeah. Those sort of have their limits. But then what comes after the protest march? What's beyond the protest march?
Yeah, well, it's and I do want to highlight here too, just in terms of beyond, I'm not going to argue against e-petitions. They have their place, and it's good to put them out there, and I sign them too, and whatnot, and I go to the protest marches as well. It's just we do need to do something more than that. We need to. It's sort of an epic political time that we're living in for lots of reasons. And so we need to be epic too. And if the world has 12 years, or so, you know, to stop, global warming rising above 1.5 degrees Celsius, we need to be thinking through some strategies and actions, that are commensurate with that situation. It doesn't really work, you know, hey, on a Saturday, let's hand out leaflets and then, I don't know, you know, not do something for months or whatever.
Right.
And so there is an aspect to sustained pressure, which is, you know, every week or, you know, on a regular basis. It's easy, I think, for politicians and corporations to ignore sort of a one-off protest, whatever the size it is. It's harder when it's an ongoing action that builds. And I've been particularly inspired as of late by this movement that was launched recently in the United Kingdom called Extinction Rebellion, which is really kind of interesting. And they frame it as a rebellion and nonviolent protest, and they describe it actually too as respectful disruption. So they basically argue that, look, we've signed petitions, we've gone on these marches, we've written our letters to the editor, we've met with our MP, we've done all those things, nothing has changed, the crisis has only worsened, and so we need to step up in some way. So, I mean, they've been engaging in a campaign over the past few weeks where this past weekend they you know, blocked the four roads that lead into Parliament Square in London and did a larger protest. They also had a kind of a mass sit-in in front of 10 Downing Street where the Prime Minister's office, they even went to Buckingham Palace and called on the Queen to, you know, protect the realm kind of thing, which I thought was kind of interesting. The week before, about 6,000 of them occupied five bridges in central London and shut down traffic, you know, in the inner core of a major European city, and have more actions planned. And prior to that, you know, had been doing other actions. And so I think with that kind of sustained economic disruption, as it were, that there's a greater chance of of gaining the attention of governments and corporations and pushing them. We'll see how it unfolds, but there's now a number of Extinction Rebellion chapters, as it were, forming around the world, and really probably in the space of a week, 10 days, something like, well, more than 2,000 people have signed up on Extinction Rebellion Facebook pages in Canada, and there's chapters in, or Facebook groupings at least, in Guelph and London and Hamilton and Barrie and Peterborough. And so I think there's something about, we can't just keep doing the same. It can't be business as usual. We need to invigorate the movement. We need to escalate our tactics, because that's what the situation is demanding of us.
Right.
So that's kind of where that is. And I think within local community organizing, there's all kinds of collective wisdom. There's all kinds of experience. There's all kinds of good thinking in terms of what we do beyond e-petitions and protest marches. I'm not going to presume to say I know the answer or anything like that, but I just think we need to be thinking in that way, because it's what the moment demands of us.
And it's something that strikes me too, though, is that I think the name Extinction Rebellion sells itself. I think it's great, but I think that my concern is that there's very little, and maybe this has always been true, there's so much tolerance among the general public for something like shutting a bridge down or shutting a road down that, you know, I think of the Canada Post strike too. The emphasis of the coverage was on the businesses being hurt by no parcel delivery or by a backlog in postal delivery. There wasn't much mining in terms of, are the concerns of the postal workers, have they been given fair airing? Have they been sort of vetted by the media in terms of trying to get us to understand what the core dilemma is about? And I think that speaks to that we have no stomach for disruption anymore. If it's inconvenient, it's automatically bad because we have been inconvenient. That's the ultimate sin.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And here, I guess what I'd say, this is one of the reasons why I think it's really important to read independent media and read critical perspectives. I mean, you know, what they say about, or what Malcolm X said about, you know, mainstream media is it'll have you believing that your enemies are your friends and your friends are your enemies. And so, you know, solidarity with our postal worker friends, and because, you know, for all of us when we support, what you're saying in terms of the, not having a stomach for disruption. And I had been wondering about that. I have not heard that. Surprisingly, what I saw of the coverage of the occupation of the bridges in London wasn't sort of public outrage. It wasn't, well, we weren't able to drive here or there kind of thing, which I had thought and which one would think of in terms of, you know, similar actions in this country. I think it's wise. It's a prudent point that you're raising. It's something we should be looking at. But, I think there is also, the hard work of communicating the argument in terms of the climate crisis,
right.
Communicating the argument, whatever your age may be, on your own life, for your children, for your grandchildren. I mean, it is of that kind of level of seriousness. So to say that, disruptions aren't taken lightly, it's they're taken seriously because concern for others and the planet and the level of the of the crisis. So to do that communication, and you know, and maybe it's, you know, how you communicate before an action is done. Certainly the occupation of the bridges, that was well publicized beforehand. So it's not like someone was driving and then, hey, what's this kind of thing? So I take your point, but I think it also just speaks to the work that has to be done so that more people come on side on this. And I mean, I certainly support the postal workers, but you know, it's possible that some people see that in a very, you know, it's that small group of people, and I want my Christmas package to go through. And so there's that. I think on something like climate change, there's, you know, well, unless you're wealthy, there's really no escaping it.
Right.
So there's a commonality there.
Well, I wonder if, you know, on something like climate change, I wonder if we underestimate people, because when you hear these phone surveys that, you know, the majority of people are concerned, I just wonder if we don't tap that, if that's, you know, sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy on the part of the media, on the part of politicians, that we don't talk about it because we don't talk about it, and we've sort of tricked ourselves into thinking the public doesn't care, when maybe the public really does care much more than our politicians and the mainstream media think.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I do think people care. How can one not care? I think the issue is that that credible alternatives need to be put forward. People need to see a way forward. They need to have a sense that something can be done. And you know, without that push, without that information, without that vision, without that hope, then I think then it is possible, I think, for people to sort of retract, as it were, into I just don't even want to think about it. I'm not going to think about it. You know,
right.
What you might about, I don't know, any problem, I guess. But so I think we need to be saying there is a way out of it, and there is a way out of it. There is. It just requires public pressure and political will. And some pretty big systemic changes, but there is a way out of it. I mean, I can't remember the figures now, but there was, I just read something today in terms of, you know, in the first weeks or the first months, of the second war, how there wasn't sort of manufacturing capacity around, airplanes, fighter planes and all that, and how quickly that turned around because it had to turn around, and because there was government support, and because there was money available, because there was a war effort. And I don't want to particularly frame things in a kind of a militaristic way, but you know, there are ways to respond collectively to a collective crisis, and we just have to find our way to that.
Right. Maybe to wrap up, do you ever worry about burnout? I mean, you've been at this a while, but I feel like the crises sort of pile up. That, you know, speaking as my own, for my own political feelings, that, you know, you sometimes just feel overwhelmed by, you know, the anger, inaction on climate change, inaction on authoritarianism, inaction on equal rights. And, you know, does it ever worry you that, you know, you might just, like, one day, or that the, you know, people who you work with, the movement itself just burns out because there's too much happening too fast, and change doesn't, or does it ever come swiftly enough?
Yeah, well, I think as I say, activist burnout or burnout is a real thing. We're up against big things, and you know, there's not enough people doing the work, and it is overwhelming, and the odds, you know, aren't always so great. I think there's, you know, I think sometimes it's even just acknowledging that is helpful, right?
Mm-hmm.
Acknowledging that things are difficult rather than pretending that they aren't is helpful. I think sometimes, you know, particularly when there's, you know, an intense campaign, to know that, you know, sometimes people do need to step back and others will step forward, and, you know, finding some balance, you know, is necessary. It's not a, you know, even with the limited amount of time the UN says, this is still a marathon we're running. It's not a sprint. So we have to pace ourselves, accordingly. But I think also, you know, you really sort of meet the best, you know, loving, caring, committed people within activist circles. And so I think there's also a lot of, you know, in that community, a lot of support and energy that comes from working with others, you know, in a collective, in a group, towards something that benefits everyone. So it's a good point you raise, and I think we need to be attentive to it. But again, I think there's also, you know, approaches to it that help us all keep going.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a lot of us hope you're right.
Me too.
Well, Brent Patterson, thank you so much for your time, and I guess we will look forward to hearing more from you when you get to town on Wednesday night.
Okay, lovely. Thank you so much.
And once again, that was Brent Patterson. You can find his writing on rabble.ca, and you can hear from him directly on Wednesday night, that's November 28th, following the Council of Canadians AGM at the main branch of the Guelph Public Library on Norfolk Street at 7 p.m. It will be in the community room on the second floor. And that's it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The host for the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes. And while you're there, you can also listen to Open Source's Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson. Go to Guelph Politico's Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you would like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, please consider donating to the Guelph Politico effort, and you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, we'll see you next time.